From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. George Shultz has written his memoirs about his years as Secretary of State under President Reagan. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the Iran-Contra scandal and what Reagan and Bush knew. Shultz will also tell us why he thinks it's time for military action against the Serbs. Human Rights Watch has just issued Volume 2 of its report on war crimes in Bosnia. We'll talk with Executive Director Arye Nair about what he saw when he was in Sarajevo earlier this month. Maureen Corrigan reflects on two recent events in Washington, D.C., the opening of the Holocaust Memorial Museum and the Gay Rights March. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that the United States shouldn't undertake military intervention in Bosnia unless it has clear goals and a strong likelihood of success. Christopher told a Senate panel that the administration must also have a clear strategy for getting out of the situation after it's been involved. The secretary was responding to calls from some American lawmakers for Allied airstrikes against Serbian artillery positions in Bosnia. Supporters of such a strategy say it would force the Bosnian Serbs to take part in the peace process. Senator Ernest Hollings said today that Allied airstrikes are only likely to strengthen the resolve of the Serbs to fight on. On the day tough new sanctions went into effect against Serbia and Montenegro, Serbian fighters from Croatia launched an attack against a Muslim-controlled area in Bosnia. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
Officials of the United Nations peacekeeping forces said an estimated 1,000 Serbs, equipped with about 10 tanks, artillery, and mortars, crossed the border from Croatia into what is known the Bihać pocket of northwestern Bosnia. Citing the Geneva Convention on Human Rights, the UN Protection Forces Commander-in-Chief, General Lars Wahlgren, said in Belgrade that UN troops stationed in Bihać will protect civilians from any attack and will protect their homes from being torched. About 300,000 people live in the Bihać area and are supplied by UN humanitarian aid. UN Civil Affairs Officer Cedric Thornberry said the action against Bihać is mysterious, that the Serb troops that crossed into Bihać are all men in their 50s, and that it could be a provocation. But he added that it could also be a local and crazy initiative. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
The Middle East peace talks resumed today in Washington with increasing pressure on Israel and its Arab neighbors to make some genuine progress. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher today urged Arab and Israeli negotiators to focus on substance during the ninth round of the Mideast peace talks. Christopher made his remarks at the State Department to Palestinian delegates, as well as those from Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. This is the first round of talks since negotiations were suspended last December, after Israel deported more than 400 Palestinians to South Lebanon. The Jewish state claims the deportees have links with the radical group Hamas, but Israel says it will allow them to return to the West Bank by the end of the year. And in an apparent goodwill gesture, Israel announced that it would repatriate 35 Palestinians it deported between 1967 to 1987. All are believed to be supporters of the Palestine Liberation Organization. I'm Sunni Khalid in Washington.
The Dow Industrials gained 17 points today to close at 3,416. This is NPR. Government scientists are disputing Exxon Corporation's claims that Alaska's Prince William Sound has substantially recovered from the Exxon Valdez oil spill 4 years ago. Scientists working for the oil company are appearing at a symposium in Atlanta to present their findings that the oil spill caused no lingering damage to fish, animals, and birds along the coast. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration challenged that research today, saying the findings are based on misinterpretations of government data. The Food and Drug Administration said today that it will approve the first female condom to help protect women from AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases if the company making it meets certain conditions. NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports.
The FDA says it will approve the female condom as long as the company uses labels that make it clear that male latex condoms offer the best protection against AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. The label must also show that female condoms are not as good contraceptive devices as other methods. And Wisconsin Pharmacal, the company making the condom, must do additional studies on the effectiveness of the condom. The FDA says it is prepared to approve the product despite questions about its effectiveness, because women currently have no other devices they can use to protect themselves against sexually transmitted diseases like AIDS. The female condom is a polyurethane sheath with a flexible ring on each end. One ring is inserted like a diaphragm, the other remains outside the body. This is Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
Russia will be putting some once-classified military technology on sale next month in London in an effort to raise hard currency and boost manufacturing at former defense companies. Among the technologies that Russia is offering for sale are techniques for making synthetic diamonds and using nuclear fuel. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's become customary for presidents and their cabinet members to write memoirs after they've left government in which they reveal their versions of what happened behind the scenes. George Shultz has just written his memoirs about his years as Secretary of State in the Reagan administration from 1982 to 89. Shultz also served in the Nixon administration as Secretary of Labor, Secretary of the Treasury, and Director of the Office of Management and Budget. What's been generating the most interest from his book is his telling of the Iran-Contra story. He says that he fought to stop an arms-for-hostages deal in four major battles, and each time he felt that his view had prevailed. But he writes, this snake never died, no matter how many times he hacked at it. And because he opposed arms for hostages, he was sometimes kept out of the loop.
There was an awful lot that took place that I didn't know about.
Mm-hmm. One of the important meetings that you describe was a meeting on January 7th, 1986, in which the Vice President, George Bush, was present, although he says he had been completely cut out of the loop. But at this meeting, arms for hostages was discussed, and you said that you and Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense at the time, were the only ones who opposed the arms for hostages deal.
I didn't just say that, I know that.
Right. So that means that Vice President Bush was there, that he knew what was going on.
Well, he also knew that Cap Weinberger and I objected and thought this was a very bad idea. And that's why both Cap and I were astonished to read later on in an interview he gave to David Broder in the Washington Post that he said if he had known that Cap and I objected, that might have had an impact on his own thinking. But he was present and he heard us object.
Are you suggesting that George Bush is a liar?
No, I don't know what led him to make that statement, but it was surprising to both Cap and I. Cap called me and said, how could he say that? He was there.
During the last presidential election, the issue of Iran-Contra became pretty important, especially toward the end of the election when a little bit of new information was emerging. Did you feel any responsibility to come forward with what you knew about George Bush's knowledge of the arms for hostages deal?
Well, I didn't know very much, and this particular thing I just related was public, and other things were public. But you must remember that at the time there was an indictment of Cap Weinberger, and he was to go on trial on criminal charges. And I felt, and I consulted my attorney, and he advised that I should not get involved in a lot of public discussion of the Iran-Contra matter because of possible intersection with this criminal case. So I kept my mouth shut.
Can I ask if you voted for George Bush?
Yes, I did.
In spite of the fact that you feel he misled the American public about what he knew?
Well, there were many other things that I thought that he did well on, although I can't say that I am a big fan of the Bush presidency.
You say you weren't a fan of the Bush presidency. What were your major criticisms of his presidency?
I didn't think they stood up very well to the economic developments. It was clear fairly early on that the economy was in a very lackluster stage, and nothing seemed to come forward in recognizing that and dealing with it analytically. I didn't think they paid anywhere near the attention that should have been paid to the Asia-Pacific area, particularly Japan. I felt that they were slow to take up where President Reagan and I left off with the unfolding of the drama with the Soviet Union and in the Soviet Union. And the START treaty was delayed. I think if we'd all be much better off if the treaty had, for reducing strategic nuclear arms, had gotten signed much earlier and progress was underway in reducing those nuclear arms and the verification infrastructure in place and so on.
You write in your memoir that you knew you had to fight for the presidency by fighting against members of the president's own staff.
That was in the Iran-Contra business, because the staff, I felt, was misleading him.
What was the strongest thing that you did to fight for the presidency by fighting against the president's staff?
Well, I went to him repeatedly saying, you're being misled. Here are the facts. Here's what people are saying. Here are the facts. They're different. And I argued with him. And after he gave a press conference in which I felt, and this is all in the book, that things were stated that were not correct, I asked to see him, and I went to the family quarters in the White House with him. I took Don Regan with me so somebody else would be present. And I just went through, here are all the things you said are wrong. And I had the kind of discussion with him, criticizing him, that I never thought I'd talk to a president of the United States like that. And he accepted it and listened, although I don't know how much I moved him. So I objected, and then almost by chance, I was on a television interview show with Leslie Stahl, Face the Nation, and she gave a good, tough, strong interview. And at the end, she asked me what I thought about arms sales, and I said, under the circumstances of Iran's support of terrorism, our hostages being taken in Lebanon with their complicity, and the Iran-Iraq war, I didn't see any excuse for any further arms sales to Iran. And she said, do you speak for the administration? I said, no, which is a terrible thing for a Secretary of State to have to say. But interestingly, that smoked out the White House, and the next day the president said that I did speak for him. And that began to break the logjam, and gradually things came my way.
I'm actually very interested in that answer that you gave Leslie Stahl on Face the Nation when she asked you if you had the authority to speak for the administration and you said no. Did other answers flash before your mind before you said no?
No, it didn't. It was just I think you have to answer these questions as honestly as you can, and that was an honest answer.
Well, I mean, the way to answer these questions is often with great vagueness. I mean, I've witnessed enough interviews to know that.
Well, sometimes you have to be vague, but mostly I think it's better to be direct, as I'm trying to be direct with you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that a big problem was that President Reagan kept saying and truly believed that we had not traded arms for hostages and that you couldn't get Reagan to recognize what had actually happened. What were some of the ways that you thought he was deceiving himself?
You have to start by recognizing that he felt a sense of personal responsibility and obligation to the Americans that were held hostage in Lebanon, and it just bothered him a great deal that they were being tortured, held, and as President of the United States, he had an obligation to do something about it. So that meant, as people realized that, he could be probably gotten to rationalize something that under other circumstances he might not have been bought, would have been more hard-headed about. And I think it's an exhibition of a bad performance on the part of the staff, because if you see a president who has a kind of a weak point like that, your job is to help him guard against it. But at any rate, under those circumstances, he bought the line that if we sell arms to Iran in mild proportions, maybe that's a way to create an opening to Iran and develop a different and new relationship with Iran. And in the process, we'll get hostages out. And so he arranged it in his mind that this was not arms for hostages.
Former Secretary of State George Shultz is my guest. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is George Shultz. He's written a new memoir called Turmoil and Triumph, My Years as Secretary of State. Bill Casey, the head of the CIA, produced a press release saying that all the president's advisors were aware of the Arms for Hostages operation and support it, although Casey knew very well that you opposed the operation. How did you feel that he expected you to sign on to this?
Well, this press release was sent to me by Poindexter as I was on my way to a meeting of the Organization of American States in Guatemala, came on the plane, and with the advice that all the other people involved had agreed to it, and they wanted to release it, and they wanted my sign-off. And I said I wouldn't sign off on it because it wasn't true. And I insisted that it be changed. And this was among the things that I did that led people to be very dissatisfied with me and say I wasn't loyal. But I felt I was the one who was being loyal to the president in trying to get this thing stopped.
You say that Bill Casey, the head of the CIA, was the person who really drove the Arms for Hostages policy.
I came to that conclusion at the end because here I found, after Poindexter had gone and North had gone, still this operation I discovered was going on, and Bill Casey, I saw, was driving it.
How was he driving it?
Well, he was conducting it. I found that the CIA had a dedicated line to the intermediaries they were working with Iran. It was a shocking thing. And I discovered a document that had been worked out by a person from the CIA and Oliver North that contained matters that I thought were terrible, but at any rate, the CIA was much more involved, I saw, than I had appreciated before.
You fault Bill Casey on more general principles for trying to shape American foreign policy with his intelligence reports, for basically offering intelligence in a kind of selective and biased manner.
Well, I wouldn't say that was a general proposition, but I think there were instances on important things where the policy proclivities influenced the intelligence. And there were areas where he was particularly involved, and the Central America was one, Iran was one, Southern Africa was one, where his policy views were different from mine, and I felt I was speaking for the administration. At any rate, it was a struggle. And I think it's a fact that the director of the CIA should not be a policy person. That person should be an analyst, an intelligence collector, an analyzer, and the person presenting the best intelligence he can, and not be a person who takes positions on policy issues.
Can you clarify for us what you think President Reagan knew about the Iran-Contra scandal and how early he knew it?
Well, I think that I don't think there's any mystery here. He knew about the fact that arms were sold to Iran. He was glad to see the hostages return. He arranged those facts in his mind in the way that I described earlier in this interview.
Mm-hmm.
He did not know about the diversion of funds from the sales of arms to the Contras. He said that repeatedly, and I believe him. So that's sort of what he knew.
My guest is George Shultz, who's written his memoirs about his years of Secretary of State under President Reagan. Let's turn our attention to Bosnia. You have said that you think we should take some kind of strong military action that we can't stand by and watch this new Holocaust that's happening now in Bosnia. What kind of action do you think the United States could take militarily that would be effective?
I think we should be very aggressive in the United Nations and saying what we think and making it clear that we're ready to take part strongly with our military forces. And it seems to me it should be recognized by now that the United Nations effort to date has just been a failure. And we need to start on a different track. And I think it should be made clear to the Serbs that we are willing to mount a very strong aerial and naval effort to hit their gun emplacements, to take out their supply lines, to hit where ammunition and other military arms are stored, supply depots, military training establishments, and in general reduce drastically their ability to make the kind of war that they've been making. And when we do that, I believe you'll find that the Serbians become more reasonable and maybe some outcome, certainly a ceasefire and then a reasonable outcome can be worked out. I think there are other things we should also do. We should allow arms to go to the Bosnian Muslims that want to defend themselves.
Was there a turning point in your thinking when you started to believe that we should use military force?
Well, I have always observed in my experience in the labor relations field and my own experience in bargaining that strength and negotiations go together. And I think it's a theme in the book. As I look at the Reagan period, and this was one of the things the president fully realized, and it's something that's very apparent in the Bosnia situation. We've had people negotiating, but they haven't had any strength.
What are the risks if we become militarily involved in Bosnia?
I think we should draw a red line against the risk of putting in ground forces. I think that would undoubtedly involve us more massively with more casualties than we should want to accept.
Just one more question. What kind of toll does it take on the body to be under the kind of stress that you're under when you're Secretary of State, both the kind of stress of making decisions, the stress of the political differences you have with people, and also the stress of jetting around the world, one trip after another in these big high-pressure meetings? I just really wonder about, how the body holds up under all of that.
Well, I'm 72 years old, and I'm feeling strong and fit. On the other hand, I did see when I left office that I was much more tired than I thought I was. When the adrenaline disappeared, I just slept and slept. It took me a couple of months really to revive and feel, in a sense, normal. But my body seems to be fit. And I think when you travel, you have to think about that. And I developed a little pattern that helped me at least a little bit with jet lag.
What was it?
And that pattern is to try not to eat too much before and the day before you leave. Don't drink anything alcoholic. Don't drink anything alcoholic on the trip. Eat as little as possible. Sleep if you can. Try to get yourself psychologically on the time zone you're going to. And so arrange your schedule that when you get there, if possible, you don't have anything to do right away, so you can go and take a little rest and maybe get some exercise when you arrive that helps that. And then I find you adjust more easily.
Hey, this could be your next book, a self-help book, dealing with jet lag from a former Secretary of State, one who should know. George Shultz, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
George Shultz's new memoir is Turmoil and Triumph, My Years as Secretary of State. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum was dedicated in Washington this past Thursday, a ceremony marked by Elie Wiesel's impassioned denunciation of ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. When commentator Maureen Corrigan visited the museum yesterday on its opening day, she too found the museum to be a morally restless place that inspires much more than safe, nostalgic shame about the Holocaust.
The last room you enter as you walk through the Holocaust Museum is called the Hall of Remembrance. It's the only room in the museum that you'd be tempted to describe as beautiful. A chamber with six high walls of limestone, it's empty, except for the light. Sunlight pours in through a glass ceiling. Rows of candles flicker against the walls, and in the center of the room, an eternal flame is burning. But yesterday, after 4 hours of walking through the dim, black and gray expanse of the museum, I reached the Hall of Remembrance and saw something jarring, a shock of pink. Next to the eternal flame, somebody had left a bouquet of pink roses and a card imprinted with the words, "Never Forget," above a pink triangle. That's the sign the Nazis invented to identify homosexuals. Now it's a symbol of pride. The dedication of the Holocaust Museum this past weekend in Washington overlapped with the lesbian, gay, and bisexual rights march. I'd like to think that by letting that pink bouquet stay by the flame, museum officials were affirming the rightness of that scheduling coincidence. I'd say that every fourth person in the museum crowd yesterday was a leftover marcher, women and men wearing pink triangle buttons, red ribbons, and rainbow necklaces. They already knew part of the lesson the Holocaust Museum dramatizes, that is, what it feels like to be feared, even hated, because of being different. But what they didn't know, what no one but the Holocaust survivors in the museum crowd knew, is what hatred of difference looks like when it's carried to its farthest extreme. Some philosophers have argued that the Holocaust is not a metaphor for anything, that its unique evil can only represent itself. But I think the designers of the Holocaust Museum disagree. They've presented the Holocaust as history and as a metaphor for the annihilation of difference. There's been a lot of coverage of the museum in the past week, so you may have heard about how it tries to break down an ordinary visitor's psychological distance from the Holocaust by making you walk through gates cast from the gates of Auschwitz and through an actual boxcar that carried thousands of people to the camps. You may have also heard about the oral testimonies and videos, the room filled only with musty shoes, the gas chamber door, the striped prison uniforms, the piles of rusty razors. Because this is such a nightmarish trip, the museum assigns you a spiritual companion, a real person who lived through the Holocaust and whose photo and identity card you carry with you. My guide was Teresa Halpert Katz, a Hungarian Jew and a good student whose traditional family refused to let her pursue her studies. I thought we were a good match. At printing stations along the way, I updated Teresa's story, and I learned at the end of my tour that she was gassed when she arrived at Auschwitz in May of 1944. So I was grateful that I was in the company of other people on my walk through the museum yesterday. Not that we spoke. Aside from a whisper here and there, nobody spoke. We couldn't even meet each other's eyes. But to be surrounded in that museum by hundreds of men and women who had marched on Sunday to insist that their differences be seen and respected was for me an unexpected grace, like a splash of pink amidst the colors of death.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Human Rights Watch has just issued the second volume of its report on war crimes in Bosnia. The report calls for a war crimes tribunal in spite of the obstacles against bringing Serbian war criminals to justice. The report also criticizes the international community for failing to suppress attempted genocide. We'll talk with the executive director of Human Rights Watch, Arie Nair, coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials of the Clinton administration rushed to the defense of the North America Free Trade Agreement after Budget Director Leon Panetta was quoted as saying that support on Capitol Hill for approval of a free trade agreement is weak. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Panetta's assessment that NAFTA lacks current congressional support and is therefore dead forced administration officials to perform damage control. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor said Panetta was talking about NAFTA before three important side agreements on labor, environment, and import surges are negotiated. Cantor expressed confidence that once those side agreements are complete, NAFTA would be approved by Congress. But he declined to comment on the current level of support for NAFTA.
Oh, we have no estimate. There's no reason to start counting votes until we have the supplementals. Then we'll have a realistic view of how people feel about it. I think it's impossible to get that kind of realistic vote right now.
Cantor also said today that the administration hopes to see the trade pact extended to three other Latin American nations, Chile, Venezuela, and Argentina. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
American pressure on Israel for concessions to the Palestinians reportedly was a vital factor in resuming the Middle Eastern peace talks. Analysts expect Israel to present a set of new offers soon. Alex Brody of the BBC reports from Jerusalem.
The concessions Israel would give to undercut Palestinian militants and show that it's worthwhile returning to the peace talks have been hotly debated for weeks. The full details remain guarded, but leaks here suggest that 35 veteran deportees will be allowed home, there among some 1,200 expelled in the 70s and 80s. Dubbed extremists then, they're now considered moderate, such is the change wrought by the rise of Islamic militancy. Also, Israel will respond to Palestinian grievances about human rights abuses in the occupied territories, perhaps consenting to a human rights working group, facilitating family reunification, easing the current closure of the territories, which is depriving tens of thousands of work and income. What the Palestinian negotiators want, however, is a comprehensive lifting of the army's iron fist policy, which they call collective punishment and the Israelis say is counter-terrorism.
Alex Brody in Jerusalem. In Washington, a new round of Middle Eastern peace talks is underway after a four-month-long suspension. Secretary of State Warren Christopher told the various parties involved to stop talking about procedure and start addressing key issues. Christopher met with the leaders of all delegations to the talks in their first gathering in one room since the start of the talks in October of 1991. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 17 points to close at 3,415.93 on volume of 284 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. Despite tougher UN sanctions, Serbian forces in Bosnia launched a new attack on Muslim strongholds in the northern part of the nation today. Leaders of the Bosnian army said that they had no part in these attacks that they blamed on local forces beyond their zone of operations. A UN military official said that he had ordered French troops in the area to use force in order to protect civilians. There are now some 300,000 civilians trapped in the region who depend on UN aid convoys for food and medicine. The Massachusetts-based Students Against Driving Drunk announced today it will not accept donations from the liquor industry, reversing an earlier decision by its board. Jeff Sutherland of member station WBUR reports.
SADS board of directors had come under fire from its members for deciding last month to lift a moratorium on accepting donations from liquor manufacturers. The board originally made the decision because of its worsening financial state, but now says on reconsideration it will not accept liquor money. But board member Donna McBride says the organization did get some financial relief today, as the founder of SAD, Robert Anastas, gave up the remainder of his controversial $1.4 million retirement package.
Mr. Anastas voluntarily asked the board to stop all remaining payments of his retirement fund. In addition, his consulting contract has also been suspended.
But even so, the organization still faces a $150,000 deficit, and it says it has depleted its reserve fund. For National Public Radio, this is Jeff Sutherland in Boston.
A new study by the Conference Board finds consumer confidence moved up this month for the first time in 4 months. The private research group's index finds confidence in April at 67.7%, after a reading of 63.2% in March. However, a spokesman for the group warned that a single month of improvement after 3 months of decline is not convincing. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bosnian Serbs voted down the Vance Owen peace plan earlier this week, and new UN sanctions against the Serbs are now in effect. The debate about whether we should take military action against the Serbs has intensified. My guest, Arije Nayar, is the executive director of the human rights group Human Rights Watch. They've just issued the second volume of a report on war crimes in Bosnia. The report calls for a war crimes tribunal and criticizes the international community for failing to stop attempted genocide. Nayar was in Sarajevo during the first week of April. This marked the first anniversary of the siege of Sarajevo. Conditions seemed to have temporarily improved. A ceasefire was in effect, and the harsh winter was ending.
More important, I think, than those things were what I sensed as an intensification of the city's sense of its own multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural character, and a determination by quite a lot of people to celebrate that, even as they were being attacked for that. I've come to believe that the siege of Sarajevo is not only a matter of ethnic cleansing, but I think it also represents an anti-urbanism, an anti-cosmopolitanism, and the city is loathed by a lot of the people who are attacking it. They precisely loathe that multi-ethnic, multi-religious character of the city. They're doing their best to destroy it, and some of the citizens of Sarajevo, a lot of the citizens of Sarajevo, are taking all the more pride in that character of the city.
It's an interesting perspective. What led you to the conclusion that part of the reason for the siege of Sarajevo is that it's urban and pluralistic?
Well, one talks to people on both sides of the conflict. One tries to read their materials, and one gets a sense of that from the way they describe Sarajevo. It appears as though the attacks on the city have been aimed at the destruction of the varied cultural monuments of the city. The city had 5 centuries under Ottoman rule, and therefore it has an old Turkish quarter and Muslim and mosques which reflect that history, but it also had an Austro-Hungarian past. It has Catholic churches, Orthodox churches, synagogues, and all of those have been targets. I would say that the single building which seems to have been shelled more than any other is probably the National Library, and it's the building that people mourn particularly in Sarajevo. Another major target has been Oslo Bajenje, the newspaper, and it still functions from the basement of the building, but upstairs everything is destroyed. It appears that the shelling has the aspect of a cultural war, that is, wiping out the cultural symbols and the diversity of the city.
You actually went to a multicultural seder while you were in Sarajevo. What
Yes.
was it like?
Well, it was quite extraordinary. It was extraordinary because the main language that was used was Ladino, and Ladino is a dialect of Spanish, and it reflects the fact that the Sarajevan Jews came to Sarajevo 5 centuries ago at the time of the expulsion from Spain, and they have preserved Ladino. So it wasn't only that the passages from the Seder were read and chanted in Ladino, but in addition, the leader of the community made a welcoming speech to the community in Ladino. In addition, the chief Muslim cleric of the former Yugoslavia was one of the guests. The Catholic Archbishop of Bosnia was one of the guests. The leader of the Orthodox community of Sarajevo was there. A representative of the Seventh-day Adventists were there. And I thought that this demonstration of all the religious groups taking part in the Seder was intended as a manifestation of this pride in the multi-religious and multi-ethnic traditions of the city.
Your group has been calling for a war crimes tribunal. This week, lawyers with the United Nations War Crimes Commission said that they had little confidence that a war crimes tribunal could amount to anything, because as long as the Serbs are still in power, there's no way anyone in a real position of power will be tried, and it's unlikely that the Serbs will emerge defeated. The lawyers also said that it's likely that the first cases that would be tried in a war crimes tribunal would be against middle or lower level people. So it's still up in the air whether the Security Council will pursue this or not. Do you think there's still any point in pursuing it?
Yes, I think there is very much of a point. I disagree with the statements that were attributed to the lawyers who were quoted in the press. The lawyer who was quoted principally was Commander Fenrick, a Canadian lawyer who was one of the five members of the Commission of Experts on War Crimes that the UN established last October. And I must say I've been quite disappointed with that commission. I don't think that it has worked nearly as hard as it should have. I would exempt from that the one American or Egyptian-American on that commission, a Professor Sherif Basuni of DePaul University in Chicago, who I think has to some extent made up for the laxity by the other members of the commission. My view is that if you bring war crimes prosecutions, the same sequence should be followed as was followed at Nuremberg and at Tokyo after World War II. That is, the people with the highest level of responsibility for the most egregious crimes should be tried first. I don't think it's as difficult to bring prosecutions against those people as has been suggested. One of the provisions of what is called the first additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions. And this is a protocol which sets out many of the war crimes which would be considered by such a tribunal, is that commanders and leaders who have information on war crimes that are being committed under their direction and who do not take all feasible measures within their power to prevent and suppress war crimes are themselves guilty of war crimes, which means that General Mladic or Radovan Karadzic or any other leader in this conflict would have to show that they took steps to try to end the detention of civilians in detention camps, that they took steps to try to end the shelling of civilian population centers such as Sarajevo or Cerska or Srebrenica, that they took steps to end the rapes and the mass killings. They can't show that. They didn't take those steps. So I think that the possibility of convicting them would be very great.
Well, how do you bring somebody like Radovan Karadzic, who is the head of the Bosnian Serbs, how do you get him to come and stand trial while he's still in a position of power, while people are still trying to convince him to negotiate or to sign on to a peace plan, you know?
I don't think it'll happen in 3 months or 6 months, but I do think that if international sanctions are maintained for an extended period, at some point the Bosnian Serbs would turn him over. Bear in mind that there have been war crimes trials resulting from World War II up to the present moment. And if you have a tribunal and if the world community is willing to be patient and leave that tribunal in place, at some point, he is going to be turned over. At the very least, he would never be able to venture outside the borders of his own country. And how many countries are willing to be pariahs for the very long term?
My guest is Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. The group has just issued Volume 2 of its report on war crimes in Bosnia. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is Aryeh Nayar, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. The UN has taken a beating from many critics in how it's been handling Bosnia. In February, your group, Human Rights Watch, called on Cyrus Vance to halt peace negotiations until war crimes like ethnic cleansing were halted and until humanitarian assistance was allowed to be delivered to civilians in besieged communities. Why did you want Cyrus Vance to stop peace negotiations until then?
Well, it seemed to us plain that the peace negotiations were being used by the Serbs as a cover for the continuation of ethnic cleansing. The mediators were calling on the international community not to intervene forcefully in the conflict on the ground that this would disrupt the peace negotiations. That's what the Serbs wanted. It allowed them to keep cleaning people out, keep shelling these civilian cities, and more war crimes were being committed while these negotiations were taking place, and I think they were taking place in bad faith on the Serbian side. That seems more apparent in retrospect than it did at the time, but it seemed fairly apparent even at that moment.
Now that the Bosnian Serbs have voted down the peace plan, do you think that that peace plan is dead?
I'm not sure it's dead because I think that there is another cynical maneuver that is possible. I think it's possible that at this moment they will reconsider and they will sign the peace plan. But at this moment, they will have altered the situation on the ground. They will have driven people away in increasing numbers and have made more and more parts of the country ethnically pure. And then they will count on the fact that the international community will not demonstrate the will to repatriate people to the areas that have been cleaned out, and people won't want to go back if the areas remain dangerous, if their houses have been destroyed, if they can't make a livelihood in returning to those places. And so the peace plan will continue to appear to legitimize what I think has been a horrendous set of events.
You criticize the international community for lack of will. Sanctions are going into effect against Serbia now. Does that sound effective to you?
Well, it certainly is a lot better than nothing. I think that if the War Crimes Tribunal were created, that too would be a lot better than nothing. But there is a solemn duty that the international community undertook when it adopted the Genocide Convention and when various nations of the world ratified the Genocide Convention. The nations that ratified the Genocide Convention pledged that they would act through the United Nations to prevent and suppress genocide. They have not done so. And then the question arises, what's the meaning of an international treaty if the governments that are parties to that international treaty are not willing to honor their obligations under it?
What recommendations would you have for upholding the convention?
Well, at this point, let me say that I'm speaking personally because I'm going to go beyond the policies of the organization that I have directed, Human Rights Watch. My own view is that at this date, there really is not any alternative to military action. I think it's possible that if at an earlier point the U.S. and the U.N. had intervened more forcefully, had simply said, we declare these places safe havens, you may not attack them, that that might have been successful. I doubt that at this late date that something of that sort would succeed. I would start in that fashion. I would start by saying, if you continue to attack these places, there will be retaliations against your artillery. And I think that that would have some effect. I can't say what effect it would have.
When was the last time you supported military action?
It's been a long time. I can't recall very well. I will recall this, and that is I was a childhood refugee from Nazi Germany. I lived in England during World War II. I certainly never thought that there was any alternative other than military action in trying to defeat the Nazis.
I wonder if you find that there's a new set of alliances and kind of shifting alliances on the issue of what to do in Bosnia. I mean, for example, also on our show today is former Secretary of State George Shultz, mm-hmm. who also feels that there should be some kind of military intervention in Bosnia. President Clinton isn't sure about that and is thinking that over, but says that a stronger policy on the Balkans is needed. But I wonder if you find yourself siding with people who you've never sided with before.
Well, I've told a number of people and shocked some of my friends by saying this, that I am nostalgic for Margaret Thatcher, that I'd love to see somebody with her kind of backbone in public office today.
And you never would have said that before?
I never would have said that before.
My guest is Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what's the news from Bosnia today?
Well, there are conflicting reports of another Serb offensive at another region of Bosnia, this one near the Croatian border. Also in Washington, Secretary of State Warren Christopher on Capitol Hill told senators what conditions there would have to be for the U.S. to actually take some military action, conditions such as there'd have to be a clearly defined military mission. We'll also be hearing today about what voters, this time in Indiana, make of the first 100 days of the Clinton administration. You know, Linda Wertheimer is traveling cross-country on Route 50, and this reflects her talks in Indiana, as well as Noah Adams talking with the musical group Beau Soleil.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You're just joining us. My guest is Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. I'm wondering if you think, you know, a lot of the people in Bosnia, particularly in Sarajevo, are urban, middle class. And I think, you know, I think there's an identification that a lot of middle class Americans feel with a lot of the people in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you think that's affecting the sentiment of those people in their desire for military intervention.
I'm sure it is.
Because there's this sense of identification.
I'm sure it is that if something horrendous takes place in Sudan, it's more difficult for middle-class Americans, middle-class Westerners to identify with, let's say, the people in the Nuba Mountains in Sudan. We have only a remote idea where that is. We don't get that much information on what's happening to them. Or if we think, let's say, about the Rohingya Muslims in Burma, who have been treated abominably by the Burmese government and have suffered terribly, again, those people are so remote, we know so little about them. And I worry about this matter of intervening in Europe when we don't respond to comparable abuses that have taken place in other parts of the world. The other side of that coin, however, is that there is always the excuse that we didn't know what was happening in those remote places. We don't understand those remote places. When it comes to Bosnia, everybody has been informed on what's taking place. It's on the front page of the newspapers every day. It's on radio and television every day. So when we know it all and when we have it right close to us because it's in the center of Europe, if we are unable to act under those circumstances, my view is, how can we possibly respond to what is taking place in a Sudan or in a Burma? I would hope that if the West or if the international community responds to what is taking place in Bosnia, that some of the dictators and demagogues and those who are fomenting ethnic and religious strife in other parts of the world and causing these great disasters would begin to wonder whether the international community would respond to them too, and I would hope that would have some deterrent value.
Do you think about the dangers that we might risk in getting involved militarily in Bosnia?
Yes, of course. There certainly are dangers. I don't want to say that one should ever approach the idea of military involvement lightly. I am not advocating the use of ground troops, and it's not that I have any special repugnance at the use of ground troops, but I am influenced by all of the comments that people make that we don't want to get into a quagmire. But I do think that the use of military force would reflect a willingness by the international community to do something significant with respect to the crime of genocide that is taking place in circumstances where everybody knows about it. And I think for the sake of the international community, as much as for the sake of the people in Bosnia, it's important that the world should respond to what is taking place.
I want to ask you, I know you'll be leaving Human Rights Watch in mid-May for another position.
Yes.
What are some of the greatest frustrations you've experienced in your years heading Human Rights Watch?
Well, the great frustrations are that one, on the one hand, seems to be making a certain amount of progress in dealing with human rights because there's a greater consciousness of human rights worldwide than there was, let's say, a decade ago or a decade and a half ago. On the other hand, the number of abuses of human rights doesn't seem to diminish. There doesn't seem to be some great advance in mitigating the violation of human rights because of the strengthened human rights movement worldwide. And as I see the proliferation of ethnic and religious conflict in the wake of the end of the Cold War, one wonders whether the fall of communism has produced the kinds of great advances in human rights that had been anticipated 3 or 4 years ago.
When you're dealing with work that's very frustrating, and I'm sure it's very frustrating to try to get governments to respect human rights in many parts of the world, you remind yourself of victories that you've had, that it is possible to achieve victory. What are some of the victories you've reminded yourself about over the years to kind of give you the energy to go on?
Well, I think there have been a great many victories in Latin America. When I started with Human Rights Watch, the southern cone of Latin America, that is Argentina and Chile and Uruguay and Paraguay, all had military dictatorships, and the human rights abuses in those countries were horrendous. Disappearances, summary executions, torture on a massive scale. I think that the human rights efforts that focused on those countries were a major factor in producing transformations, and those countries largely respect human rights today. So I'm delighted with the transformation that has taken place in that region. Elsewhere in Latin America, there have also been changes. El Salvador was the country on which I personally focused much more than any other for a period of several years. And I think that El Salvador has emerged from its nightmare. I think that there is a good prospect that El Salvador will respect human rights in the years to come. And the role that we played in helping to bring to an end the death squad killings and the bombings of civilians in the countryside was probably an important part of the transformation.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arye Nair is the outgoing director of Human Rights Watch. He's also a columnist for The Nation. He soon becomes president of the Open Society Fund. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Iraqi dissident writer Kanan Makia. In his new book, he reports on the Iraqi campaign to annihilate the Kurds, and he criticizes Arab intellectuals for keeping silent over escalating cruelties in the Arab world. Makia wrote the bestseller about Iraq, Republic of Fear, under the pseudonym Samir al-Khalil. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.